Welcome to What You Missed This Week. I'm Joe Weisenthal. This is the new podcast that has the best and most interesting interviews from the Daily Market Close Show that I co-anchor with Scarlett Fu and Julia Cheddarly on Bloomberg Television called What You Miss. Our aim is to take you beyond the headlines and bring you unique perspectives on the week's top stories and, well, those that you may have just missed. It's the perfect way to kick off your weekend. We spoke with Sam Abu-El-Samid, Navigant Senior Research Analyst, about the future of autonomous driving. Sam discussed how the technology industry and the auto industry are coming together.
I think it's actually a bit of both, commercializing faster and getting up to scale. Over the last several years, SoftBank has been making a whole flurry of investments into mobility, in the mobility service segment. They've got investments most recently here in the U.S. with Uber. They put about $11 billion into them a few months back. Also in China with Didi Chuxing, the predominant player there, Ola in India, and numerous other companies around the world. But what they haven't had is a supplier of vehicles. Now this gets them a connection into a manufacturer that can supply vehicles that can be fed into all of these various other services.
Sam, put a Cruise GM's self-driving car unit into context in terms of how it stacks up against other competitors in the autonomy race. How is it, you know, how are its business prospects versus, say, Waymo, which of course everyone knows about, but obviously they don't have their own car manufacturing operation?
Yeah, so GM's been working on autonomous technology for a lot longer than pretty much anyone. You know, I mean, they started talking about it back in, at least as far back as the 1950s, but really over the last decade, they've been working on it pretty aggressively. And bringing in Cruise a couple of years ago to help with really getting productionizing their autonomous driving software, I think has helped them a lot. I had a chance to ride in the vehicle around San Francisco back in early December, and their technology, I would say, is pretty much as good as anyone's, you know, just shy of Waymo's. But as you say, they do have the manufacturing scale. And they've also got some other capabilities, like they have a network of dealers that can be leveraged to provide service and maintenance operations for these mobility services.
You know, what's interesting in all of this, of course, is that we hear about what Tesla's doing, we hear about what Uber's been doing with self-driving vehicles, and I think people tend to forget that GM had been making quite a bit of progress here. SoftBank, of course, does have an investment in Uber. So where does this leave a company like Uber?
I think for Uber in particular, you know, with the problems that they've had, you know, they've really struggled with their development of automated driving systems, and I think I wouldn't be at all surprised if in the not too distant future, if they perhaps just phase out their own internal development program entirely and focus on working with OEMs like GM. They also have a deal that they struck last year with Daimler to deploy some of Daimler's autonomous Mercedes-Benz vehicles on the Uber platform. And, you know, their competitor Lyft has been doing the same thing, getting deals with various companies that are actually manufacturing the vehicles to deploy those vehicles on their platform. So I think it's going to, I wouldn't be surprised to see Uber refocus on that part of it, get the logistics platform, along with all the other things that they've been expanding that into Uber Eats and freight and other areas, and working with these companies to get vehicles that can support all of those different applications.
We saw, Sam, a pretty dramatic rally today in shares of GM on this news. When you talk to people out there, do you think there is a lack of awareness at the degree of that GM is basically one of the market leaders in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there's somewhat of a lack of awareness that the auto industry in general, you know, has really been working hard on this for quite a long time. You know, all the attention obviously has been focused on Silicon Valley, and there's a lot of great ideas that have come out of the Valley. But, you know, I think, you know, what the manufacturers bring to the table is both the manufacturing capability, but also the knowledge and background with safety systems and being able to make systems that are going to be robust and reliable in real use. And now they're combining that. I think the two sides, Silicon, the technology industry and the auto industry, are starting to converge and come together and each bring their strengths to the table to collaborate to really try to make these systems viable for real-world use with humans.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned real-world use, Sam. How far away are we from having a scalable commercial service? And who's winning that war? And if we are several years away from that, is there still opportunity for other players to come involved here and get in on the action?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we're looking at right now is, you know, all the teams, you know, rushing into the first corner of the 24 hours of Le Mans. there's still a long way to go. To as they say in racing, to finish first you must finish. And so I think the first players that we'll see commercializing the technology will probably be Waymo. They've promised to launch commercial service by the end of this year, GM next year, and then a whole slew of other companies over the next couple of years. But in these first 3-4 years, what we're going to see is very limited deployments in very specific locations. They're all going to be geofenced to areas where the technology can work reliably, where we have high-definition maps to support it, and all the other infrastructure to support it. For the vast majority of people, they won't have access to autonomous vehicles for probably several more years at least. So there's still plenty of time for other players to get a slice of this market. You know, in the next 4 to 5 years, we're looking at no more than, you know, tens of thousands to, you know, by the early 2022-23 time frame, we're looking, you know, maybe a couple of 100,000 vehicles, but it won't be till the mid 2020s that we start getting into millions of vehicles, and there's lots of time for other companies to get a part of that pie right now.
Sam, is autonomous driving going to be a winner take all or winner take most type of industry, or will it be like the auto industry itself right now, where you have a lot of different players that make that are at commercial scale?
I think it's going to be more like the current auto industry, where there will be a number of players. It'll probably be fewer players than what we see today in the auto industry. There will be some more consolidation, but I think that there won't be just a single player that wins it all. There's plenty of room for everybody. There's a wide variety of services that are going to be needed, and companies with different expertise in different areas will all be able to profit from this business going forward.
We also spoke with Mark Chandler, Brown Brothers Harriman Global Head of Currency Strategy. Mark discussed investor anxiety about Europe relating to the political situations in Italy and Spain.
Part of the banking regulations, both in the U.S. and in Europe, seem to have discouraged banks from trading their own account, like the Volcker rule. And so maybe in other circumstances, people might have come in when the Italian 2-year yield moved by like something like 15 standard deviations. A huge move. Like the sun should not be burning while this happens. It happens anyways. Someone would have come in, I think, in under a different regulatory environment and maybe tried to buy those bonds.
Who?
Like we saw at the auctions today.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, you've got a lot of different people who buy bonds at such a deep discount. For example, you've got a lot of fund managers who have to track. They get evaluated based on what they do relative to a benchmark.
Sure.
A lot of these passive investors who might have to buy Italian bonds because Italy's issuing more bonds. Mm. They buy more of the Italian bonds. When should they buy them? You just had this huge jump, I mean, in not only for Italy, but also relative to, say, Spain or to Germany. And so there were some value investors, I think, in other times, especially the banks, could have come in.
So moves like yesterday, you said the sun shouldn't even be burning, so like they're supposed to happen like every once every 150,000 years or something
like that. But it's like the flash crash we saw with the sterling. We've seen this with treasury bonds, that something happens where the markets can be acting functioning normally, and then at some level they just like break down. And I think that breaks down partly because of the regulatory environment, but not only because of the regulatory environment, because there's a lot of shocks coming to the market.
Aside from the market structure or technical issues relating to Italy, have people just gotten too complacent about this fact that populists keep winning in Europe, and more there's this anxiety about the current system seems to be bubbling to the surface?
I don't know. I mean, when you say populists keep winning in Europe, I think that Italy is the first time that the populists have won.
Fair enough.
But I do agree with you that what happened yesterday was the biggest move since before the French had their vote last April.
Right.
Whether it's measuring the risk, measuring how many people think that the Eurozone might not survive. So I think that anxiety is running very high in any event.
And it's not just Italy, of course. Spain also has its own political issues as well. How did that kind of exacerbate the situation when it comes to, I don't want to call Italy a peripheral European nation, but the non-core European countries, the non-Germanys and non-Frances?
Yeah, where the third largest country is a periphery, and you're right, in terms of behavior, you've got a real problem in the
Eurozone.
In terms
of how investors behave.
No, I agree with you.
Exactly. I think Italy, Portugal, Spain, they're lumped together, partly not because of the size of the economies, but because of the macro situation.
Yeah.
And so I do think that having the outcome in Spain is a lot different. They're going to have a vote of confidence on Friday. If the government collapses, they have to have new elections. most likely winner, the largest party in Spain now, is a moderate, sort of investor-friendly. But in Italy, the likely outcome, the two biggest parties, at least right now, are not so market-friendly. But I suspect that what we're seeing now is just the beginnings of a division between the five-star movement, which is populist, but it's also more like a social democratic party, versus the Northern League, or the League as they call themselves now, which is nativist, nationalistic. They are the only party that's gone up in the polls since the March election. So they want to fight for the get a new election. But the five-star movement seems willing to compromise. Right. For example, name a new finance minister. So now for the first time, it's not this coalition, whole coalition, but we got fractures in it. And that's going to give us a little bit of optimism going into the election, probably late July or early August.
That we could ultimately see some kind of center-right formation of a government. What does all this mean for the euro? Because we obviously saw the dollar rally. We've had all sorts of people predicting 115 by the end of Q2 in terms of euro-dollar. What do you think on this currency pair in particular at this moment?
Yeah, so we've actually come a long way. What I find the most remarkable thing is if you look at the commitment of traders in the futures market,
yes,
they are still nearly record long euros. Whether you look at the net position, that's longs minus shorts, you look at the gross longs, the market has, despite the euro falling roughly 10.5 cents since the middle of February, the long euro positions haven't been shaken out yet.
So what are they short against?
Well, mostly the dollar, as far as we can tell in the futures market. But there might be some crosses, but it's primarily people who think that the dollar couldn't rally during a Trump administration, can't rally during because of the twin deficits, can't rally because of a trade war.
Right.
And so I think everybody's leaning the wrong way, and that's when we come soaring back.
Yes.
The Italy story has taken some of the spotlight off of Turkey, which had been the big anxiety for markets for most of last week. Has Turkey done enough? It's the lira's actually had a nice run here, bouncing off the bottom here.
Sure.
Have they done enough to staunch the bleeding for now?
I suspect not. And I think the test is coming up as early as next week, because the central bank says they'll raise interest rates again if inflation gets worse. Well, given the sharp depreciation of the lira, we've got to anticipate inflation is going to get worse.
Right.
So they're going to have to hike rates. And I think at some point, you know, I was around when the Irish raised interest rates to over 100% overnight rates. And then they devalued. And if you bought the currency because of such high overnight rates, you still lost when they devalued.
Right.
And so I think that at some point, central banks cannot raise interest rates enough to compensate you when you have a foreign currency.
Such a great point.
So it all kind of ends in tears, however you...
I'm afraid so.
Yeah, however it gets decided in the meantime.
And Paul McNamara, GAM Investment Director, joined us to discuss emerging markets, including Turkey. Paul told us that he sees both Russia and Colombia as opportunities in EM currencies.
It's not so much allowing them to repay in local currency as setting the rate. So it's protecting the firms at the cost of the government, to the taxpayer, from the losses incurred due to the weaker lira. But it's not going to stop the lira falling. I mean, it's all very well hiking rates, and I think this is the third time they've done it in recent months. But what they do is they hike rates, then they expand their credit guarantee scheme, which is a government scheme which encourages banks to lend. So you're pumping more credit, it's more expensive, but you're pumping more credit into the economy, the external balance deteriorates, and things keep getting worse. And then, just to be extra helpful, last week President Erdogan was in London, met with investors. I mean, the lunch in particular, which Bloomberg organised, was a complete car crash from an investor point of view. There was the famous, well, you know, if you look around the world, you see high interest rates and high inflation go together. Therefore, high interest rates cause high inflation, and what we need to do is to cut interest rates. And so everybody came out of the meeting, came out of the lunch, and sold all their Turkish exposure, and they were actually sending the central bank head and one of the economy ministers, Mr. Shimshek, to London next week to try
damage control.
Exactly.
I mean, how do you damage control? Their president doesn't understand finance.
It's a good question.
What would you have to see policy-wise, whether from the government or the central bank, to say these are the type of moves that signal the lira may be ready to stabilize?
Actually tighten credit. Don't just raise the price of it, but just stop expanding.
So quantity.
Yeah. Bring the quantity of credit down. Not quantitative tightening. Just bring the quantity of credit down. But that will have impact, because I think we're already at the stage where, you know, credit is very expensive in lira. If you've been borrowing in dollars, it's getting more expensive. So it's a difficult thing to do.
And is that a difficult policy to do in the run-up to the election when Erdogan is so sensitive.
Yes, and also when we're already beginning to see signs of distress. Right. We're seeing debts restructured. We're seeing major corporations clearly in financial distress.
The big question has been, you know, is this a Turkey-specific story, an Argentina-specific story, or is this an EM story broadly? And if you take a look at this chart, you could see the yellow line is the Argentine peso falling 24% so far this year. It's normalized as of the end of last year. The blue line, there it goes. That's the Turkish lira way down. And then you can see that white line just kind of coasting along, and that's the MSCI Emerging Markets Currency Index. So is this a broader issue, or is it just really a specific story?
It's two things. There's the specific stories in Argentina and Turkey, which are the two countries which are running big and expanding external deficits. But there's also the broader story of the US dollar. I mean, it's always been the case. If the dollar rallies against the majors, the euro, the yen, on average, if the DXY, the Fed's trade-weighted index, goes up 1%, the dollar goes up 1.4% against EM currencies. And that's what's happened.
So are you prepared to go into either Argentina's or Turkey's currency at this point?
Argentina, we think, looks interesting, because Argentina to us looks fixable. The much lower level of private sector credit, they can live with higher interest rates and start to bring things round. Turkey, we don't see signs to do more than hike rates and then pretend that's tightening credit.
Well, now that we've kind of compared the two, are there any lessons that Turkey can draw from Argentina, the way that Argentina has approached its currency crisis?
Not really. I mean, they're two very different countries. One's a commodity exporter, the other's a big commodity and especially an oil importer. Their economic structures are very different. What they both have is trouble getting the locals to trust the currency. Mm-hmm. They're the two emerging markets where people don't hold their deposits in the local currency, so they need to rebuild trust.
So when it comes to Turkey, I mean, obviously, what Erdogan's been saying about interest rates and questions about the independence of the central bank, these are old stories by this point, right? I mean, this has been going on for years, some of this rhetoric, his belief that high rates cause inflation. Is there, you know, there's been this idea that the election could bring stability, but from a economic or currency standpoint, can there be stability under the current government?
I think there can, because, I mean, the AKP's been in power for 13-odd years, and things have been getting things, you know, we've had good periods there. But they need to get credit under control, which is what they need to get the current account under control. So, yes, they can, but I don't think they will. Mm.
You talked about the stronger dollar being another drag on emerging markets overall, emerging market currencies overall, separate from the Turkey and Argentina story. EM obviously suffered during the 2013 taper tantrum.
Yep.
And you've made the point that this time is different from then. Why? Explain.
Never a fun argument to make. No, what's different is that in 2013, if you look at emerging markets, the broad complex, they were running a trade deficit. Take out China, they're running a trade deficit of $25, $30 billion a month. At the moment, that same group, even including Argentina, even including Turkey, are in balance. Emerging currencies are more systematically weak when you have external deficits, and you don't have the external deficits now.
Let me just jump in here with a headline. Moody's may cut Italy's rating, its Baa2 credit rating. So this is a headline that just crossed. Italy's Baa2 rating may be cut by Moody's.
Speaking of EM, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, ooh,
speaking
I
of
don't
the lira.
Know, not quite yet.
Yeah.
Just
speaking of the lira.
Real quick, I'm just wondering, are there any other currencies in the emerging markets where you're seeing opportunities right now?
Russia, I think, is our big opportunity. When you see the oil price up here, and to a lesser extent, Colombia, the two big oil exporters which have local currency debt. I mean, Venezuela is Venezuela. But I think Russia and Colombia stand out because usually, given the strength we've seen in oil, we'd expect much more response from those, and we haven't seen it this time.
And that's it for What You Missed This Week. Subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to podcasts, and make sure to watch our show every weekday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg TV and 4 to 5 p.m. on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.